Kierkegaard and Existentialism was presented by Charlie Dewberry at the 2007 Summer Institute entitled Soren Kierkegaard. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
All right. Well, I think we'll get started. First, I'm Charlie Dewberry. I'm a tutor here at Gutenberg. My background is really in the sciences, and although my PhD is in philosophy, it's primarily philosophy of science. And as I looked at the possible lecture topics, this one seemed to me the one I had the best shot at. And even at that, it wasn't a great shot. And you'll find that as I go through this, I'll tell you this now, that along about the middle to the end of last week, I had an existential crisis over existentialism. And I'll explain that in a few minutes, what I mean. But what I'm going to talk a little about is Kierkegaard and existentialism. And I'm going to narrowly look at this. Basically, I'm not going to spend much time talking about Kierkegaard. There's people here that know a lot more about Kierkegaard than I do. But I want to stay with just a couple of his crucial points and follow them through, follow the influence those ideas have had in philosophy. So that's what I'm intending to do. Whether that's existentialism or not, we'll decide that when we get there. So what I want to really focus on is it seems to me that if you boil down the influence that Kierkegaard has had, it's his interest is really narrowly defined about Christianity and what is true faith. And I think if you boil it down to one sentence, for Kierkegaard, something other than reason is necessary to account for the Christian experience. That, I mean, I think that's one of the nuggets, probably the nugget for Kierkegaard. And it's really that idea that I want to trace a bit. And I've alluded already to the second major point I want to hit, and that is existentialism really is not a school of thought. It's not reducible to any set of tenets. So, I mean, what is it? Who decides? And as I found more and more as I get older, it gets harder and harder to nail things down like existentialism. But what I'd like to do first is let's back up. And what I want to raise is, where are we in the history of ideas when Kierkegaard really, when he's writing? What's really going on? What's been the flow? And what does this touch? And maybe why? So I want to start, I started working my way back, and I think I can start at the Middle Ages and capture most of what I want to capture. But just a couple comments about the Middle Ages to get us rolling with the history of ideas here. First, in the Middle Ages, the focus is on Christianity and the development of a Christian worldview. I mean, that's really largely what the medieval, the project, philosophical project really is in the Middle Ages. And as I look at it, it's really about balancing the sets of authorities they have. They have three. One is Greek culture, one is church tradition, and the other is the biblical text. The medieval project is somehow bring those things together, make them into a coherent package. We've got three authorities here, and all of approximately equal status. I mean, it varies a little bit from individual and time, but basically that's what they're dealing with. It's a period of time where you have those three authorities. And out of that came an understanding of faith and reason. And I'm not going to talk about in detail their understanding of faith and reason. I think some of that's going to come out this week. But I don't want to spend much time talking about that part right now. So, okay, how about the next period, which I'll call the modern period, and the first part of the modern period, I'll characterize it as the Enlightenment Project. So what's the transition here? What's happening now in the modern period as opposed to the Middle Ages? What is it we're coming out from under? What is it we're moving into? And it's a whole different project. The project is focused on increasing man's knowledge through science and harnessing technology to solve man's fundamental problems. So it's a view that basically says, look, when we look closely at the real problems of man, we think that through science and technology, we're going to solve those problems. And humanity will now be content, happy. We'll have all the stuff we need to live a good life. So that's the essence of the Enlightenment Project. And science is the foundation of that. So one of the things that happens here in the modern period is, if you look at who ultimately were the figures of authority in the Middle Ages, it was the theologians. Who ultimately are the authorities in the modern age? It's professional scientists. They become the new priesthood, if you will. So science then replaces Christianity and theology on the main stage. That's what we're really focused on. That's what's going to solve humanity's problems. The authority becomes the individual man's reason. Think of people like even Luther here, or Galileo. They're standing up to their culture and saying, through my own reason, I believe this is true. That becomes the foundation of the authority structure. It's no longer the Bible, the church, tradition, or Greek culture. It's now reason. Reason is now basically the authority that we're going to, on the basis of reason, will grant authority to beliefs. An important person involved in this debate and discussion and development of the modern period is Kant. And buried in Kant is something I remember back from the 60s that had a profound influence on me. There's a story of Kant basically saying, take out a paper bill, money. Let's say it's a $100 bill. We'll be American here. So you take out a $100 bill, and what Kant says is, well, look, in my concept of a $100 bill, we know what that is. Now, we could also have the concept of the possibility of a $100 bill. What does that change about our concept, our thought? Kant concludes that doesn't tell us really anything more. The idea, so the concept, the thought of a $100 bill or the possibility of a $100 bill, for Kant, if the issue is theoretical knowledge or science, those aren't different. Well, what's the implication of that? The implication is, well, wait a minute. We know there's a great deal of difference between a $100 bill that I can deposit in the bank and up my bank account and the possibility of a $100 bill, which doesn't do anything for me in reality. It has no existence. Well, Kant says, reason can't deal with existence. That's not what it's about. reason tells us about things. So, one turn of Kant's here is that what reason tells us is now we can go to science. What science tells us is the qualities of objects. But science doesn't tell us about the existence of objects. That's metaphysics. And the whole line of philosophy, it was buried in Descartes. And it's really Hume that rooted it out. But basically, in science now, which has become the foundation of the culture and our pursuit of what's important, we basically took existence out of that equation. It's not about existence. It's only about its attributes. Existence is a metaphysical term. Metaphysics is out. So, in large part, the philosophy of the Enlightenment period is really wanting to do away and purging metaphysical terms, including existence. So it seems to me that's an important backdrop for Kierkegaard. Secondly, now we come to the problem of Hegel. And I've, for most of my life, had no idea what to do with Hegel, and I still have little, if any, idea what to do with Hegel. But actually, in thinking about this, I came to at least a clear idea of what Hegel's project was and why it was attractive. Is Hegel actually agrees with the Enlightenment project. He agrees that reason is the ultimate authority. The rational is real. So he's echoing an idea all the way back to pre-Socratics, like Parmenides. If existence can't be thought, but only lived, the only option is to leave it out of our picture of reality. So for Hegel, what exists then is the rational. The rational is ultimately what's real. However, it seems to me that what Hegel really wants to do is really bring this element of existence that wasn't in this picture of reason. Reason's sort of this cripple. You know, it's partially conceived correctly, but it's only partially put together in the way that people like Hume and Kant have put it together. So it seems to me that one way to look at Hegel's project is that he wants to bring existence into his system. The weird thing is reason through logic is what's going to bring it in. So he's going to use reason and logic to bring existence into his system. Well, this is even bringing reason to a point where it's even more omnipotent. It's now a richer concept. So where does Hegel begin? And this will maybe help understand where it's coming from a little bit. But as soon as this is over, anybody who can understand this, I'd appreciate you letting me know how to understand this. Because what Hegel says is, we begin with being. Okay, well, what is being? Well, it's an empty concept to start with. It's absolutely empty. And it has no existence. So, okay, Hegel, what the heck is being? It's an empty concept. But its antithesis, what its opposite is nothingness, nothing. So you got being on one hand, it's an empty concept. And nothing on the other hand. And through a dialectic process of the interaction of these opposites and this process beginning to work, as the process unfolds through mediating and reconciling concepts and synthesizing both of them, you end up getting reality and existence. Now, that's the foundational move to build his system. So, see, in a sense, like I say, I don't understand. I don't understand all the pieces here, and I'm not understanding how it's working. But the point I want to make is, through reason, Hegel is aiming at bringing existence into reason. He's seeing that reason is, although it's an authority, it's our authority. The understanding of reason at that point, it's incomplete. It's insufficient. It just doesn't explain and do what we need it to do. So that's the best I can do with Hegel. So like I say, anyone who can help me actually unpack and understand that, please let me know.
Should we not talk? Should we save everything till the end?
Maybe save it till the end. Save it till the end. I'm not going to talk a long time, as you'll see. It'll become evident why here in a minute. I'm gonna run out of things to say rather quickly here. But the one thing about Hegel that's really important, I think, for understanding Kierkegaard is Hegel claims to be a Christian. And as we'll see in a few minutes, I think that's a really important piece of the context. Okay, so now Kierkegaard. Well, we've been talking a lot about Kierkegaard, but just the little bit of it that I want to focus on here. I mean, we all know at this point, we've all seen that Kierkegaard's interest really, his concern is really narrow. What he's really interested in is Christianity, and he's looking at the church of his day, and his real interest is Christianity in the church. But the problem that he sees is, in large part, that many of these philosophical ideas, both Kantian, Hegelian, that they've somehow found their way into the church and they're becoming the foundation of major parts of Christian thought. So his interest really isn't the implications of his ideas to broader philosophy. His interest is primarily just the church. But what happens, in effect, from a philosophical point of view, is within Kierkegaard's answer, within his answer to the problem and solution of Christianity in his day, embedded in that is a fundamental critique of Western philosophy. Now, that wasn't his intent, but that's the implications, I think, for the people who come later. Now, so now I want to make a little bit of a turn to existentialism. And this is where I mentioned that about a week ago I had an existential crisis and realizing that I don't know what the heck to say about existentialism because the more I looked at it, the emptier it became. in the 60s, anybody approaching my age, this book probably is quite familiar, written by William Barrett called The Irrational Man, A Study in Existential Philosophy. First, note the title. Irrational Man. What's that? It doesn't say non, it says ir, Irrational Man. A Study in Existential Philosophy. So right off the bat, just on the cover, for me, this is what I understood of existentialism for the most part. When I looked at the cast of characters that are part of the existential movement here, and this was 1960s, which it was 70s by the time I got there, but the 70s are all part of the 60s anyway. So, but anyway, the existentialists are Dostoevsky, Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, Heidegger, and Sartre. Okay? Those are the existentialists in the book. Okay, well, I was flying and I was preparing this lecture and I thought, great, okay, we're all set. And then I did the stupid thing of going down to the bookstore, picking up a more modern book written by Walter Kaufman. And Kaufman, although he's dead now, somebody asked me if he was. I found out he died in 1980, but he's a person that's largely responsible for bringing Nietzsche into the U.S. And he's, you know, he has done a lot of work on 19th century philosophy. Well, he wrote a book on existentialism from Dostoevsky to Sartre. What's interesting is he has a whole cast of characters here. Dostoevsky, Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, Kafka, Ortega, Jaspers, Heidegger, Sartre. Okay, well, I was fine with that. At least the names were familiar to me. I haven't read much of anything by a number of those people. Then I started to read the book. First, Dostoevsky paints a great overture to existentialism, but he's not an existentialist. Then I go a little farther. Well, Nietzsche does some great things, but he's not an existentialist either. And so, well, Kierkegaard's still here at least. And Camus and Sartre have a few pages in the back. But the majority of this book is Heidegger and Jaspers. And I'm like, I mean, I took a year of Heidegger at the university in my program. I don't have the slightest idea what he said. And I haven't read Jaspers, so what am I going to say about existentialism now? And there's nothing I can do about this at this point, because I have no hope of understanding any of these guys before Tuesday. So, existential crisis. But I think just picking up the book is helpful for helping us get a handle on existentialism and what it is and what it isn't. And so I'll just make a few observations. So first, these are the observations from the 1960s version of it. Existentialism is best characterized as not a philosophical system, but a rejection of mainstream philosophy. Well, that's a quote out of the 60s book. And basically what that's saying is that it's a rejection of the Enlightenment project in reason being the authority, in some sense. We can argue about what sense, but in some sense that's it in a nutshell. And in the 60s, it's not a system of thought nor a set of tenets. And it includes a cast of characters as different as Kierkegaard, Pascal, Sartre, Heidegger, and Nietzsche. I mean, Christians, non-Christians, very different views, very different interests. So at that point, I came away with the idea that that really existentialism was based on three things: a shared belief in the inadequacy of a shared body of beliefs. That they all agreed on that. So, I mean, right away you can begin to see the problem. Dissatisfaction with traditional philosophy is superficial, academic, and remote from life. So it's a critique on what philosophy has become. It's an academic profession. And then third, their individualism. That's fundamentally what it's about. Okay, well, after my little crisis here and looking at the different twists on existentialism that I got from the Kaufman book now, a couple observations. And some of these will be similar to the 60s one, but there's a couple differences. First, two existential philosophers may not agree on any cardinal point of their perspective. And you can virtually pick any two. It would be very difficult to find a set, I think, who would have basic agreement on foundational issues. Secondly, almost every individual that's called an existentialism disagrees about the company he's put with. He's put with. So, I'm not about them, is the response of virtually all of them. So, what's similar about them is their aversion to others. And just a point that this is not romanticism. It's not a flight from the present, either to the past or the future or some dream world or somewhere else. That, in a sense, it shares a little bit with, I think, romanticism and the idea that romanticism also isn't really about content. It's more about a critique. And so in that sense, I think it shares a little bit with romanticism, but it's not romanticism. And so lastly, then, just the point that there really is definitely aversion to the others. Well, what I would like to do for just a minute before I conclude is I want to go back to Dostoevsky for a minute to talk about existentialism. Now, it was interesting now that Kaufman says, well, he's not existentialist, but he is, this is the overture. So, you know, think of the Enlightenment project, if you can, and it isn't too hard for us to conceive of it yet, although it is passing the modern period of the role of science and reason and culture. And then this is how it starts. I am a sick man. I am a spiteful man. I'm an unattractive man. I believe my liver is diseased. However, I know nothing at all about my disease, and I don't know for certain what ails me. I don't consult a doctor for it, never have, though I have a respect for medicine and doctors. Besides, I'm extremely superstitious, sufficiently so to respect medicine anyway. I am well educated enough not to be superstitious, but I am superstitious. No, I refuse to consult a doctor from spite. The opening lines of Dostoevsky. It's signaling, you know, it's beginning to signal that Western culture is beginning to see the cracks in the Enlightenment project. And so, although that's not considered existentialism per se, I mean, it's setting the tone. Now, where are we time-wise? Okay. So now let me for a minute come back to Kierkegaard. And so notice that what Kierkegaard's theme is. And in part, you can see that what Kierkegaard is struggling with is that reason itself is not enough to get you to Christianity. And so it's a struggle with what else is it? What other parts of human existence are there besides this understanding of reason that we have? What are our other tools in the toolbox here? What is it else that we have to work with to come to a conclusion about the important things in life? And so it's that sense that I think it's that question that has made Kierkegaard important for these other folks that we call existentialists. He's put his finger basically on the notion that reason by itself is insufficient. And that, in a sense then, if you go back to the example of Kant and with regard to the $100 bill, and in Kant's concept, in the concept of a $100 bill, whether it's real or whether it's possible, it doesn't add anything virtually at all with regard to existence. So the outcome or the implication where Western culture went for the most part with that is along the idea of science then. That science isn't going to talk about existence, it's going to talk about physical attributes we can measure. It's going to basically purge metaphysics. No metaphysical topics will be in science. That was the turn, basically, from Kant. It seems to me that what Kierkegaard's doing is coming to a similar point. And then what we have now is a real live human being. And he's basically saying, he's basically confronting that turn to that objective science and saying, yes, but here I am. And it seems to me that that's fundamentally the piece that the existentialists pick up as a foundation of much of where they head with philosophy. And it goes any number of directions. So my point here is that, as we've talked about, Kierkegaard's real interest was really narrow. It was focused on Christianity per se, not broad philosophical, not a broad philosophical debate. But he came at the point in history where Western culture was becoming more critical of the Enlightenment modern project. Secondly, I think Kierkegaard's project indirectly strikes at the heart of the modern project. That is, that reason defined the way they had defined it. He's pointing out that it's an adequate account for human experience or decisions. So it's a fundamental critique aimed at basically the heart of that whole project. And third, he's had a great deal of influence on a number of writers that can be considered existentialists, although who they are at this point, I'll leave it to you to sort out, or if somebody is more knowledgeable than I am, you can give me the correct list of the existentialists. I can't do it at this point. And then lastly, his greatest influence has been on the role of human choice in experience as opposed to reason. So that's what I have.